Korah's rebellion in number 16 is something that Jude refers to as a warning to all of us. I'm Dr. Fred, and you're listening to Study, Grow, Know.
Welcome to Study, Grow, Know, where we discuss theology, prophecy, and current political issues from a conservative biblical perspective. Here's your host, Dr. Fred DeRuvo.
Hi, this is Dr. Fred. Thanks again for joining me for another broadcast episode of Study, Grow, Know. We've been in the book of Jude for a bit now. We're covering verses 11 through 13, and the last time we talked, we were dealing with Cain and Abel. We talked about that particular situation there where Cain was basically jealous of his brother Abel because Abel brought the correct sacrifice to the Lord, and Cain could have done the same thing but chose not to. And it's really interesting that even though he chose not to do what was correct and God did not accept his offering, which, you know, stands to reason, Cain got angry enough at his brother Abel to kill him, and that's what he did. He was simply jealous of Abel's righteousness. And it wasn't like Abel was lording it over Cain either. God was the one who told Cain that he had messed up. He hadn't done things correctly. So we talked about Cain. We also talked briefly about Balaam and the fact that King Balak had tried to hire Balaam to curse the nation of Israel because the king was so fearful of that nation and their possible situation where they might override him or overthrow him or conquer his kingdom. He was so fearful of that he thought, well, look, you know, if they start worshiping idols and foreign gods, maybe God will be angry with them and I will be out of the spotlight. So he tried to do that with Balaam by hiring him to curse them, and it never worked. As I mentioned last time, the situation evolved to the point that while Balaam was riding his donkey, the donkey refused to go any further because unbeknownst to Balaam, the donkey was blocked by an angel that Balaam couldn't see, but the donkey could see. So Balaam starts beating the donkey to get it moving. And then finally, the angel opens Balaam's eyes after he opens the donkey's mouth so that the donkey could actually converse with Balaam, which I find fascinating. And what's really interesting is that in the text, Balaam doesn't even seem surprised by this. He simply responds to the donkey as if it's a human being. But anyway, we see that situation. We see that at that point, once he realized what was going on, once it was explained to him and he saw the angel blocking the way, he repented. But the reality is that Jude is talking to us about apostates, dreamers, and defilers. And Cain was one of them. Balaam was one of them. And then we moved on to the situation with the rebellion of Korah, and that's found in number 16 that Jude refers to. And the reality here is that Korah, who was one of the Levites, decided all by himself that he thought Moses was going way above and beyond, and he was arrogant, and he was lording it over the people. And, you know, Korah was of the opinion that, look, these people of Israel are righteous, every last one of them. So why do you place yourself above us, Moses? And that was Korah's demeanor. And unfortunately, it got him in trouble. Now, let me read this section, because this is kind of where we left off the other day, Numbers 16, 25 through 30. Let me read that section. Moses had been attacked verbally and accused by Korah, and so he went immediately to God, which is a very good indication of how humble Moses was. He didn't react necessarily out of the flesh, although he did later on when he struck the rock, but, you know, Moses was human. Here, he goes right to God, and he presents the situation and says, what are we going to do? And then God says, you know, stand back. I'm going to kill everybody in the nation. Everybody, not just Korah and the couple of hundred men who had rebelled with Korah and their families, but he was going to kill everybody. And so Moses and Aaron interceded for the people and say, look, you know, Korah was the one who led this rebellion. Why should everybody suffer because of him? And so then, basically, Moses had said, look, you know, please save them, but if you could decide this matter for me, I'd really appreciate it, because I've got an individual here who happens to be a Levite, the tribe of Levites, one of the priests, and he's leading an insurrection. So when Moses finished speaking with God, he then spoke to the Israelites, and this is what he said. Again, this is Numbers 16, 25 through 30. He says, then Moses arose and went to Dathan and Abiram, the elders with the elders of Israel following him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, "Depart now from the tents of these wicked men, and touch nothing that belongs to them, or you will be swept away in all their sin." So they got back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the doorway of their tents, along with their wives and their sons and their little ones. Moses said, "By this you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these deeds. For this is not my doing. If these men die the death of all men, or if they suffer the fate of all men, then the Lord has sent me. Then the Lord has not sent me, pardon me. But if the Lord brings about an entirely new thing, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that is theirs, and they descend alive into Sheol, then you will understand that these men have spurned the Lord." And Numbers 16, 25 through 30. God had told Moses, apparently, to tell the people to move away from Korah, Dathan, and Abiram and their dwellings. That's in Numbers 16, 24. Moses did this, but also note that Moses goes on to say something very interesting about how Korah, Dathan, and Abiram will die. Obviously, the Lord placed this in Moses' heart when he said that the ground would open up and they would fall in Sheol alive. Let's see what happens. The next few verses here tell us the story that's in verses 31 through 35. It reads like this. "As he finished speaking all these words, the ground that was under them," and this is referring to Korah, Dathan, and Abiram and their families, "the ground that was under them split open, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up and their households and all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive to Sheol. And the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. All Israel who were around them fled at their outcry, for they said, 'The earth may swallow us up.' Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense." Now that's scary. I mean, that's really scary. Imagine you're part of this nation of Israel, and Moses has just told you what's going to happen, but you see it happen. The ground opens up, it swallows not only the men and their families, but everything that belonged to them. They're gone. No sooner does the earth open up and swallow them, and it closes again. But God isn't done. God isn't done. He sends fire from heaven. Wow. That is scary. I mean, it's so scary that the people who were not part of Korah's rebellion moved away even further from him and his household for fear that they would be affected as well. And as soon as the people had separated from Korah, the ground opened up, and the text tells us that the earth swallowed Korah, his family, and his group alive, and they went directly to Sheol. That had to have been scary for Korah and for those men. And as I mentioned, if that wasn't enough, God sent fire from heaven to destroy the 250 who rose up with Korah. They had offered incense, presumably to an idol, by the way. That's what this normally means in the Old Testament. You offer incense to an idol if you're not offering that incense to God. And that, along with their rebellion against Moses, and ultimately, of course, against God. They rebelled against Moses, but Moses was God's standard, was God's speaker, God's man for that time. He was handpicked by God. And so in rejecting Moses, they were rejecting God. And that alone was enough reason for God to take their lives. Had God allowed that to pass, it would have infected the entire nation of Israel. God was building his nation, and he would not stand for rebellion against the man that he had personally handpicked to lead that ragtag motley group from Egypt to the promised land, turning them from that motley crew into a nation that would give birth to the Messiah. And we can read a very, very shortened version of this in Revelation 12. They were to do it God's way, or they weren't going to do it at all. Now, Esau was another. Again, this is the way of the apostate. We're going to get to Esau in a minute. The false teacher who has only his own interests at heart. And brothers and sisters in the Lord, there are way too many of these people today. They are alive and seemingly doing well. And that is tragic, but God is not going to be mocked. The apostate, his pride keeps him from caring about anyone else. And he thinks he's unquestionably correct. Look at Korah. It may appear as though he was doing something for the people, but really what he was doing was something for himself. He wanted to be the leader. He didn't want Moses to do it any longer. He wanted to be the leader. He, at the very least, wanted to be free from Moses' rule, and he thought, well, look, if I come up and get in Moses' face and tell him to knock it off, and he knocks it off, he stops, then the people will be glad, and they'll probably start looking to me, Korah, as their leader. Maybe he didn't think it exactly like that, but again, at the very least, he no longer wanted to follow Moses' rule. He could have done that. He could have just stopped. But instead, he led an insurrection. So the pride keeps him from caring about anyone else, and he thinks he is without question correct in everything. He sees no need to be under anyone else's authority and the leadership because he himself is a leader. That's what Korah was. Since the apostate fancies himself a leader, why does he really need anyone else? This is why Esau became hated. And we read this in Malachi 1:3, Romans 9:13. We know Esau. He sold his birthright for a bowl of soup in Genesis 25. He did so because it was more important for him to feed his flesh at that moment than understand the importance of the fact that he was born first. The oldest son had the birthright, and it was this son that had the relationship with God on behalf of his family. Esau essentially said that a bowl of soup was worth far more than any birthright he may have inherited by being born first. He was really talking about a relationship with God here. Honestly, that's what he was talking about because, as I mentioned, the oldest son represented the family before God, and Esau was, he didn't want any part of that. Pride caused Esau to look at the situation like this, and it was his pride that eventually brought the nation Esau founded, down to nothing. And by the way, Esau founded the nation that's called Edom. So that nation was eventually brought to nothing along amidst the rocks of Petra. And it was shortly after the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple by the Romans under Titus in AD 70. It's interesting to note that according to Psalm 83, we may once again see the rise of the nation of Edom for God's specific purposes in his end time plan. But that's another story. By the way, as an aside here, it is interesting to note that Esau married one of Ishmael's daughters. Ishmael is the father of the Arab nation through which Islam came into being. That's a side note. Now, we read that the woman Esau married was named Mahalath, and that's Genesis 28:9, which also means that even though Edom is gone, modern-day Arabs can trace their roots back to Ishmael through Esau. In marrying into Ishmael's family, Esau cemented his place in history as siding against his brother Jacob, which eventually became, through Jacob, the nation of Israel. We're going to continue on. We've got more to discuss about Korah and his rebellion. And we've got, of course, a lot more to the book of Jude to go through. 25 verses. There's a lot here. And I hope you've been getting something from it. I hope you've been blessed by it. I would encourage you to just open up the book of Jude and read it. I plan on memorizing the whole thing. It's only 25 verses. I want to memorize that. I want to think about it all the time. Well, until we meet next time, I pray that the Lord will bless you mightily and richly, and may his face shine upon you. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining me. Hi, I'm Dr. Fred DeRubo of StudyGrowKnow.com. We're living in strange times, very likely what the Bible calls the end times, just prior to the last period of human history known as the tribulation. Well, at StudyGrowKnow.com, I present broadcasts each week designed to help you grow through knowledge of God's Word. Besides my broadcasts, I've written numerous books about the modern state of Israel as it relates to God's Word, commentaries for the layperson on Revelation and the Olivet Discourse, and many other books on a variety of topics, including prophetic issues. Whether it's the rapture or political issues like Islam, prophecy in general, or the end times specifically, I offer a conservative biblical perspective on these and other subjects. I hope you'll join me at StudyGrowKnow.com each week as I discuss issues that are important to you. For all our broadcasts and resources, go to StudyGrowKnow.com. That's StudyGrowKnow.com.
You've been listening to Study, Grow, Know with Dr. Fred DeRubo. Please join us each week for new broadcasts that deal with theology, prophecy, and political issues from a biblical, conservative perspective.